Well, I'm going to actually get started. Welcome to the Bioscience and Workforce Policy Oversight Division today. And we have the Legislative Auditor's Report on Workforce Programs in front of us today. And it is a, I've got a chance for about the last half an hour, 40 minutes to read it and go over the executive summary. It's a pretty interesting report. We've got a lot of work in front of us if we want to make the changes that makes the system better. From what I've read and I hope is kind of talked about today, I'll say the system was bent in ways that it shouldn't have been bent. It's not broken. It doesn't serve workers and the state and the employers that are paying for it in large regards to its best ability. And I hope that we as a committee and as a legislature this year can propose some ways to change that and bring it forth next year, because I don't know what we're going to be able to get accomplished this year with the budget problems that we have. I think that will consume so much of our time. Before I do that, though, I did not introduce our pages. One you'll recognize from last year, Ron Rallo, and the other one is a relative of a past member, Travis Wozlik, and we've had great pages in the past. The one from last year is, I don't know whether she did something right or wrong. I think she's in Antarctica. So, Travis, you could be in trouble next year. So with that, we have in front of us today the legislative auditor, James Noble, and the program evaluator, the principal program evaluator, Jody Hauer. And we have I think you have the agenda in front of you, so you have a list of other people that will be coming up to respond or add comments. I'm pretty sure we got a quorum. So, Representative Oldmiller, would you move the minutes?
So moved.
I'm sure everyone has got a chance to take a look at the minutes from yesterday, or no, wait, from April, whenever. From April, February 16th. All those in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? They pass. I was just trying to get done earlier. Mr. Nobles, Mr. Howard, Ms. Howard, please proceed. Please give us a rundown on this report.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor for the state of Minnesota. And at the table with me is Jody Hauer, who is the manager of this evaluation. Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you for this opportunity. We are actually releasing this report today before this committee, and we appreciate you providing that opportunity to us. Last year, when we were conducting our topic selection process, and all of you are very familiar with that, we asked legislators and others what issues the Office of the Legislative Auditor should evaluate, and we typically get 50, 60 or more topics. And the topic of workforce programs was really very prominent among legislators in terms of their interest and concern, and so it was selected. And I don't think that's surprising given the economic situation that we're in. These are programs that are always very important to people who are looking for work or looking to change jobs. So these programs, workforce programs, are always important, but especially in these times, they're especially important. They really touch people's lives, and they offer help, and they need to be effective. I think another reason why we needed to look at these programs is because we spend a significant amount of money on them, about $234 million in fiscal 2009. I think another reason why you wanted us to take a look at these programs is because you've done a good deal of oversight over the years, and I think you understand that there's a very complex array of programs, and sometimes it's confusing about who's running which program, how the funding streams work, and all of that sort of thing. And I think you've also had questions about how should we measure success? How do we know if these programs are working and effective? So we took on all of those issues. We conducted the evaluation. Ms. Hauer is here to present what we found and what we recommend. So, Mr. Chairman, if I could just turn it over to her. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the division. My name is Jody Hauer. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I'll walk us through the overview of the evaluation of workforce programs. I'm going to start by just providing a rundown of what we found, and then I'm going to get into a bit more of detail on each of those findings. So overall, we concluded that participants in some of the workforce programs have had positive outcomes, a good thing, of course. We also found, though, that there are some problems. One is with how the performance of the workforce programs is measured. Another is that the administration of the workforce system is fragmented between the state, the local workforce service areas, and other local providers. A third problem is that the funding is segregated by programs in a way that there's little chance for any workforce need that doesn't happen to meet the definition of those programs that are already funded of ever being fulfilled. The workforce programs that are out there are not fully integrated, and we think that that has led to some gaps in service, and again, I'll get to that in just a moment. Finally, some of the service providers receive funding without being selected through what we think is necessary, a competitive selection process. And we think the lack of a competitive selection process has produced some accountability problems. I want to set a little bit of context before I get into the detail on these findings, just so that everyone's operating from the same base of understanding. The Federal Workforce Investment Act is the law that required states to develop one-stop centers to house a whole variety of workforce programs. And in Minnesota, those one-stop centers are what we know as the workforce centers. As of the end of 2009, Minnesota had 49 workforce centers around the state, and on the slide that you can see, those yellow dots represent those 49 workforce centers. Minnesota has 16 workforce service areas. On this slide, those are outlined in white. Each of the service areas has its own local workforce council. The members of those councils are appointed by local elected officials. And those councils largely oversee the federally funded programs that are in place for adults, for youth, and for laid-off workers, which are known as the dislocated workers. Now, the set of services that is available through the workforce centers varies a little bit from center to center, but there are some fundamental services that are available throughout at no cost to any user. These include things like computers in the workforce centers through which a job seeker can come in and gain access to the online job bank. The centers also are the home base for those federal programs I just referred to, the adult, youth, and dislocated worker programs. The federal act requires that certain services and certain programs be available through the workforce centers. For example, information must be available on occupations that are in demand locally. And information must be available on how to apply for unemployment insurance. The workforce system we have in Minnesota has a mix of service providers. The state's Department of Employment and Economic Development is one of those, and they provide certain services. There are local governments and nonprofit organizations that operate the workforce centers. They provide a separate set of services. And then there are some services like adult basic education that are required to be available through the workforce centers, but they may or may not be actually physically housed there. In some cases they are, but not in every case. Then outside of that sort of main system of workforce centers is a set of nonprofit organizations that do offer workforce services, usually targeted to specific populations like refugees, as an example. Now, as Jim Nobles said at the outset, we estimate that in fiscal year 2009, Minnesota spent $234 million in federal and state funds on this variety of workforce programs. Now, that amount does exclude about $11.5 million that were spent in 2009 from the federal stimulus money. So the $234 million excludes that stimulus amount. Well, we wanted to know what are the long-term outcomes for people who use the workforce programs. And it's an important issue to try to understand, you know, what would have happened had a person not gone through a program. But that creates a dilemma, of course, because it's not easy to know what would happen to a person who has not gone through a program. So what we did is perform a comparison analysis, and we statistically matched participants in some of the programs, those who had enrolled in the adult program and the dislocated worker programs. And of course, in Minnesota, we have both the federally funded dislocated worker program as well as a state funded dislocated worker program, but they operate very similarly. So we looked at a set of people who had enrolled, and we compared them with other people who had filed for unemployment insurance. Then we matched those two groups on various characteristics. We looked at age and gender, location in the state, past work history, past earnings history, and a number of other characteristics. So we had two very similar groups, but one of them had been participants in the workforce programs. The other shared similar characteristics, but had not participated in those programs.
Did you have a question about the
number? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just clarification, if I could. I had two quick ones. The $234 million is only in the workforce centers, not in all the other grant programs? That was one question.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, the $234 million does cover what was provided through the workforce centers, but also what was awarded to some of the nonprofit organizations that do not operate through a workforce center.
And then my second question is, of the folks that you're now, when you're talking specifically about your workforce center work, the evaluation of that, do we know how many of the unemployed in the state of Minnesota actually use a workforce? What percent of people that are unemployed actually make contact with one of those workforce centers?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not know the answer to that question.
Well, I guess that just raises the, you know, thought for us as we move forward is we're spending a whole lot of money, and it would be helpful to me to know how many people are we actually impacting of the whole realm of unemployed.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do know numbers of people who have participated on a program-by-program basis. So, for instance, we have in our report a table that lists how many participants in the most recent program year were enrolled in the adult program, how many were in the dislocated worker program, et cetera. What we don't know, though, is what that represents as a percentage of everyone.
Thank you.
And to be fair, Representative Gottwell, you had a question, but after that, I think I'm going to let you finish up the whole report, and then we'll ask some questions if we could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps I could wait until the end on this, but I wanted to follow up on Representative Norton's comment. I focused in on page 38 of the report, and along these same lines, we're particularly concerned about the comment, most clients we surveyed were positive about the workforce services they received, but substantially fewer felt the services helped them get a job or connect with employers, which is really the goal of these programs. So hopefully, as you continue your presentation and as we get into questions, we can get a little more detail about where we think that disconnect is happening.
You do cover that in your report.
Mr. Chair, yes, okay. Representative, and I will be coming to that in just a moment in the presentation.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you. So we matched these two groups, compared them, and what we found is that when compared with the unemployment insurance applicants who did not participate in the programs, the participants were generally more likely to be employed. And that's true for a four-year period after they had entered the program. We also found that the participants in the programs earned higher wages than the non-participants. And we found some differences there between male participants and female participants, and I'll explain that a little bit here. This chart shows our results for women who participated in the adult program. And if you look at the horizontal axis at the bottom, that just shows the 4 years we looked at. It happens to be marked out in quarters, so 16 quarters over the 4 years. And the axis on the left shows the difference in earnings between the participants in the workforce programs and the comparison group that did not participate. And what that yellow line shows you on the chart is our estimate that the women who participated in the programs earned at least $500 more per quarter, or $2,000 more per year, than the non-participants in this program, even though they had similar backgrounds. The difference for the program participants in the dislocated worker program was somewhat less. The participants did have wage gains that exceeded the non-participants, but the size of the gain was less, and it took a little bit longer for that difference to actually appear. Now, I mentioned we saw differences between men and women participants. When we looked at the men in the adult program, we saw really very little lasting impact on the wages that were earned when we compared them with the non-participants. And it could be due to a number of reasons, but one that we've speculated about is that, in part, the economic recession is one that many economists have said has unduly or disproportionately affected jobs that are traditionally held by men. And we think that might be at least part of the reason that the men who participated in this program did not show that same advantage that the women experienced. So I'm going to move on beyond that comparison analysis. Another way we looked at how successful these programs are is to try to understand what the satisfaction was of the customers who used the services. So we surveyed a sample of the workforce clients, and we received replies from over 800 people. The people that we surveyed indicated that they were positive about the services that they received. They had very high levels of satisfaction about the services they received. But substantially fewer felt that those services helped them get a job or connect with an employer who was hiring. This particular table just picks out a piece of the data. This piece is of those participants who had enrolled in a program. It excludes people who just walked into a workforce center or may have used the online job bank from home or another remote computer. So we're talking here only about those who were enrolled in a program. But you see very high levels of satisfaction. 83% of those people we surveyed said that the staff there really knew how to help them, and they'd go back again if they had a need to do so. These next three rows on this chart show that there were far fewer of the people we surveyed who had strong satisfaction with the outcomes. Things like, you know, connecting me, the services helped connect me with employers who were hiring or helped me get a good job. Now, Deed has its own survey of customers in an ongoing way. They do a customer satisfaction survey, but that survey does not ask about that sort of second set of questions, trying to get at what the outcomes were, how satisfied people were with the outcomes. And we recommend in our report that Deed modify its customer satisfaction survey by asking clients about their satisfaction with that outcome piece, not just how satisfied they were with the services themselves. We think over time, then, that will give the department some information that will help them better understand how much that those levels of satisfaction are tied to downturns in the economy or periods of growth. I'm going to turn now to additional ways that we looked at for measuring performance of the programs. That Federal Workforce Investment Act that I mentioned requires states to report how well they measured up on certain performance measures that the federal government has imposed. And for the federal adult and dislocated worker programs, the common measures that are looked at is, did the clients get a job? How long did they stay in that job? And what were their average earnings? Now, states are subject to funding sanctions if they fail to meet the targets that are set each year for those performance measures. If they fail to meet those targets over two consecutive years, then they are subject to funding penalties. And beyond that, if the states do meet their targets for those programs and other targets that are set in place for the adult basic education programs, then the states are eligible for incentive grants. Those are additional amounts of money from the U.S. Department of Labor that are available to those states that do meet their targets. Now, our review of the performance measures showed that the measures themselves have some flaws, and we detail that in the report, but I'm going to talk here only about two of those flaws. One is that the workforce program receives no additional credit when a person who has limited schooling gets a job than when a skilled tradesperson who comes in with an AA degree gets a job. The measures will reward the programs that enroll individuals who have the strongest potential for being successful, for finding employment. Now, this can lead to selective enrollment on the part of the program providers because of that very strong incentive to enroll people who are going to be most likely to succeed. Now, I want to point out that this is not a phenomenon we in the Legislative Auditor's Office identified and discovered. It's been well known, well documented on a national level and by other states as well. But we just saw, as we went around and talked to providers in the workforce centers, that they agreed that those incentives are there. Another flaw.
Just so I'm understanding, there's an incentive to deal with better educated people than less educated people?
Mr. Chair, the incentive is to enroll in the programs those clients who are most likely to succeed. some cases that might be someone who's better educated, but it would be on a basis of a number of factors that would increase their the probability of being successful. And success is being defined as finding a job and retaining that job for a period of at least 6 months.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's not necessarily the motivation isn't necessarily having a really good report card of success, but obtaining the funds coming in both from the federal and the state because of that success. So if you recruit people that are hard pressed to get a job, your success rates are lower, your potential for the funding then is lower. If you recruit people that are going to get jobs, your success rate is high, your potential for getting funds is high. So is that not true?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's true. Now, as I said, this is something that's been well known and documented at the federal government level as well as other places. We do know that the U.S. Department of Labor has initiated some discussions as of last summer that would try to differentiate between clients who come in with very different backgrounds. And they think that there are some ways they'll be able to change the measures in a way that would account more for those differences of the incoming clients. That hasn't been done yet. I'm just saying that at least there's a recognition of the problem and at least some hope that it could be remedied.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. So the final flaw that I'll just point out this morning is that the measures show outcomes for only the short term. As I said, for in terms of job retention, we're only looking out for about a period of 3 quarters after the person exited the program. And so you have a sense from these measures of what happened in that short period of time, but we really don't know from these measures anything beyond that. We reviewed how performance is measured for a handful, 15 to 18 nonprofit organizations that have received direct appropriations from the legislature over the years to provide workforce services. And these are mostly nonprofit organizations, not entirely, but mostly, and they're mostly located in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Again, not entirely, but mostly that's the case. I'll give you a couple of examples. Lutheran Social Services is one. The Alliance of Boys and Girls Clubs is another. LifeTrack Resources is another. So there's a number of them, and I'm sure the names are familiar to you. What we found is that no standard mechanism is used to measure the effectiveness of the services across these different organizations. The organizations do measure their own performance, and they are required to report on some things, but we found that the results they report are not comparable with one another. Now, this issue, again, isn't something we discovered. You all know about it, and in fact, last year, in 2009, the legislature, as a part of the Omnibus Economic Development Bill, included a provision that requires DEED to develop the Uniform Accountability Report to try to get at some of this lack of comparability that exists now. And DEED is doing some of that. It's looking at how it can collect data on certain measures, such as what number of jobs has been affected by those programs, or what are those the return on investment for those programs, and a number of other measures. We agree with the need for that set of accountability measures. The Uniform Accountability Report will be very useful. We think, though, that more is needed, that will supply a certain amount of information that will be useful, but it's not going to be sufficient. The workforce programs are complex enough that one set of measures is not really adequate. So what we recommend is that DEED take a look at a more comprehensive set of approaches for measuring success. And by that, we mean things like looking at the customer satisfaction results and finding out what they think about their satisfaction with the outcomes, not just their satisfaction with the performance of the services provided. Looking at the results of the external monitoring that's done of these nonprofit organizations. And doing some of the comparisons we did for this evaluation, trying to compare matched groups of participants with similar groups of non-participants. Moving on now,
Before you move on, yes. Representative Gottwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This kind of goes to that point. We've been surveying them for their satisfaction with the program, and what we're finding is they kind of like the program, and maybe you can say more about that eventually. They're liking it, but they're not liking the outcomes. So now we're going to ask them more about their satisfaction with the outcomes. And I'm wondering, did you consider You get into performance measures, but I think it may be a more objective analysis that needs to happen. It's less of a asking the customers or the clients whether they're satisfied with the outcome, but did they in fact get a job that pays them something reasonable as an objective outcome rather than relying on somebody saying, yeah, you know, it was a good experience.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. That's why we think the sort of basket of different ways of measuring performance is important to have. We think that it's important to know whether the customers are satisfied, but that's not sufficient. That's why we think that kind of analysis we did, which was an objective way of comparing the participants against the non-participants, is a way to determine, yes, indeed, there actually was a higher probability of getting a job by going through the program. So we think that it's that kind of basket of comprehensive measures that really needs to be collected in order to present enough information for legislators and others to make informed decisions.
Mr. Chairman, could I just add to that, too?
Sure.
Because, you know, as evaluators, we'd like to be able to answer a lot more questions than we are with the data that we have. So I think your point is right on. But if we were at DEED and we had the resources, I think we'd like to even go deeper and find out not just did you get a job, but did you get a job because of the programs we provided to you, and then what aspect of those programs helped you. So we would want to keep cutting into what helped, what is working, what is successful. So, you know, we'd have a lot of questions. Now, DEED is going to respond to this report, and I'm sure they're going to say this is all going to take resources, and indeed it will. But I think if we really want to know how we should structure and run these programs, we need to be able to answer a lot more questions.
Ms. Nobles and Ms. Howarth, I'm looking at page 67, and I'm not entirely sure what this means, because particularly with the fact that you just brought up about resources, legislative appropriated grants and administration funding negotiated by DEED. Maybe I missed something here, but what do you mean negotiated by DEED? And because this looks like all the whole list of nonprofit organizations that we fund. So I'm guessing, and I want you to clarify it, DEED has to ask them for money?
Mr. Chair, this is a point I'm coming to later in my presentation, but let me answer your question. And the thing is that DEED is required to monitor these organizations, but for these particular organizations that receive direct appropriations from the legislature, no funding source is set aside for DEED's monitoring. So to try to make up for some of that, DEED has, in its words, tried to negotiate with some of the service providers by asking them to carve off a chunk of their appropriation, give it back to DEED so that DEED could cover its monitoring expenses. And what that chart, that table that you were looking at, Mr. Chair, shows is that of the 15 organizations for fiscal year 2010, three did that. That is, a part of their appropriation is being used for monitoring. But then the other dozen, did not. And so we've got a very inequitable way of funding that monitoring.
Thank you. Representative Norton had a question.
Yes, thank you. As the author of that bill from last year on the uniform and accountability, I'm thrilled that you find that helpful. That feels good as a legislator to have done something that's being acknowledged. However, you also found holes in it. And so I guess I'm interested in helping plug those holes. One of those, the how to pay for it, looks like that needs to be part of the discussion. Because I know we didn't appropriate funds, and the department has taken this under, you know, just its own budget to do. But I was also interested in the multiple measures component, and I guess maybe away from this table, unless you have a suggestion right now, I'd like to talk a little bit more about a second measure or a multiple measure so that we don't limit ourselves to the results and we get something that's useful. So I noticed in there you used the term multiple measures, and that would be helpful for me. You know, I'd be willing to work with folks around the table here to modify the legislation to get better information, and certainly work with the department as well. But do you have a suggestion on the multiple measures?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what we mean by the multiple measures is including things like that the participants and the comparison group of matched non-participants, and looking at those kind of outcomes, coupled with what measures are included in last year's legislation, coupled with results, summary results of the external monitoring that's done. That monitoring is the really only way that the state has an idea of how well the services are provided in the way that meets both state and federal regulations and laws. So all those things together, including the results of more subjective, but the results of the customer satisfaction survey, we think that that is a set of measures that is needed to have a good understanding, a fuller understanding of the success of the programs.
And I would just like to point out that it is Minneapolis and St. Paul Youth Employment and the Minnesota Alliance of Boys and Girls Club that apparently negotiated in better faith than the others with the department. I'm not trying to get anybody in trouble here, but I want to make that shout out to the three.
Mr. Chair, I do want to point out that not every one of these organizations was approached and asked to carve off a piece of their appropriation. So
that's good. Okay. That's good to know. And okay, can we wait and we'll finish up
here? Well, Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask one quick follow-up to what Mr. Nobles mentioned, because I think it's very important. He made the comment about wanting to drill down deeper and find out what worked and what didn't work with Indeed. And my question back to the auditor's office is, what prevented you from doing that level of analysis? Because I think that's exactly the information we need as a legislature if we're going to make substantive changes in what's going on.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think we did drill down in terms of the econometric analysis that I've described, where we compared participants and non-participants. That's an analysis that had not been done before in Minnesota. And that was a very extensive analysis, and it gave us some results that I think that no one here could say they knew about before. I think what Jim Nobles was talking about was the actual survey questions themselves and trying to use to add to the survey that the department now has in ways that will help the department and the other providers better understand what's working and what isn't. And that's obviously, as you were already mentioning, a subjective piece of the puzzle, but it's still an important one.
And I think it's really our job to do the drill down. So if you could continue.
Yes. So going back to the top of this slide, we found that the authority over the workforce programs is fragmented around the state. Now, the state administers certain programs. We've got the local workforce service area operators administering other programs. And then we've got the set of nonprofit organizations not affiliated with the workforce centers that have their set of services. The funding streams are segregated by program. Federal funding that comes in, for instance, for the youth programs can be spent only on those youth programs, which in and of itself is appropriate. But the problem with that is then if there is another unmet need out there, there isn't a funding stream to meet that need unless that need happens to be part of how that existing program is defined. We need to point out that federal laws and federal regulations limit what the state can do to try to address the problems with the fragmentation. We can't just abandon the structure that we now have in place because it is required by that Federal Workforce Investment Act that I referred to earlier. Yet we think that the fragmentation has resulted in programs that are only partially integrated with other workforce-related programs, and I want to talk a little bit about that now, because we think that that lack of full integration has led to some gaps in service. Now, in the report, we talk about gaps in service for a number of different entities. We look at unemployment insurance. We look at the programs that Minnesota State Colleges and University System has in place for people who are laid off workers, and we also look at adult basic education. But at this point, and in the interest of time, I'm going to focus my attention today on the first, the unemployment insurance applicants. Minnesotans who want to apply for unemployment insurance now do so through a very centralized system. They either go online to a specific website that's been set up for that very function, or they call into a centralized call center that's part of DEED. And this very centralized system works well for most people. The bulk of applicants are able to use that system and apply and get their benefits and get their extensions when those come into play, etc. But it doesn't work well for everybody. People who are not computer literate, they're unfamiliar with the use of computers, or they're uncomfortable with automated phone systems, have had some problems. And some of them have come into workforce centers looking for assistance. The problem is, though, that the staff at the workforce centers are actually instructed not to answer individual questions. They're not trained to do that, and many of the employment situations that these clients bring with them are quite complicated. The staff in the workforce centers are not trained to address those. In fact, they're instructed to refer those individuals to the centralized call in center or the online website. So we think there's a breakdown there for these customers who are coming in because they want some kind of face-to-face interaction, and they're being referred to a face-to-machine interaction that isn't satisfying for them. So we recommend that the Unemployment Insurance Division within the department ensure that there is some help available for these clients who have some difficulty with the automated systems. We think those clients need to be directly connected. When they're in the workforce center, the staff there are trying to help them, they need to be directly connected with those customer assistance people who are in the call center answering calls. And there are a number of ways that that can be done, but we think that it's up to the division to work with the workforce centers in a way to to put in place a process that would help these individuals. Now, these gaps in service, and obviously I outlined just the one with unemployment insurance applicants, but we think that these gaps and others that we identify in the report result largely because of those existing funding arrangements and that fragmentation and authority that I mentioned earlier. We think that the state would benefit from a process that would identify in a more comprehensive way the workforce needs that are out there around the state. And when we were thinking about this, we were envisioning a process whereby the workforce needs that are identified would actually drive the spending, as opposed to the current system where the funding streams determine what services are going to be offered. So there's a fundamental difference between what we think would be appropriate and the system that and how it now operates. We recommend that the Governor's Workforce Development Council take the lead here. We think that Governor's Workforce Development Council should lead in the initial development of a process along these lines. We suggest the council because we think the members of that council have less self-interest than would somebody who's actually directly providing services to the clients. We also think the council should work with both the department and the local workforce councils in trying to design this process. But it's really up to the council, we think, to set some statewide parameters on how it would be implemented. Obviously, if this were to take place and the needs, the gaps in service were addressed, it would likely mean a need for more funding. We talk about two options. One is to draw from those incentive grants I mentioned earlier that the state is eligible for when it meets its targeted, it meets its targets for the federal performance measures. Another option is to use a portion of the state's workforce development fund for this function. And of course, anything along those lines would require legislative approval. I mentioned earlier the independent nonprofit organizations that receive the direct appropriations, and there are about 18 of those, although it does vary from year to year somewhat. We have, in addition to those, and those are group these together because these are those organizations that have received direct legislative appropriations. But then there are another three non-governmental organizations that receive a portion of the Workforce Development Fund to provide services for the small layoffs, which in state law is defined as those layoffs involving fewer than 50 individuals. The Job Skills Partnership Board, which I'm sure you're familiar with, but it's the entity that the members are appointed by the governor, some by the legislature. Part of its function includes managing the allocations of the dislocated worker money. The Job Skills Partnership Board is the entity that allocates these funds to these three organizations. Now, over the last few years, our office, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, has issued a number of reports outlining principles and best practices for how state money ought to be awarded to nonprofit organizations. We look back at those principles, those best practices. One of those, for instance, is when such grant money is available, the information about the availability of that money should be broadly publicized. Another best practice is awarding the grants through a competitive selection process. And we compared those principles against the process that now exists to fund the 18 organizations that receive the direct appropriations and concluded that the selection process really does bypass what would consider to be best practices in selecting providers to receive state money. We recommend that the legislature avoid listing specific organizations in law and instead allow the selection of those vendors to be done through a competitive process. The legislature should specify goals that it wants to see filled, But it, in our opinion, if we were to base our selection on the competitive best practices model, the legislature would leave the selection of the actual individual provider up to that selection process. And similarly, we think that the Job Skills Partnership Board should have a more open and competitive process for awarding grants to those beyond, perhaps, those three organizations that right now are providing some services to the small layoffs. Well, we also looked at principles and best practices for monitoring state contracts. These are things like making sure that there's a formal site visit with the organization that received the public dollars during the at least one site visit during the contract period. We also looked at another of the best practices was following up on the results of the monitoring that is done. And again, we compared these principles for monitoring the state contracts with the situation that's now in place, and we came to the following conclusion, and that is that DEED does have the responsibility for monitoring the nonprofit organizations that receive these direct legislative appropriations, but its monitoring has been inconsistent. And beyond that, the point that Representative Mahoney already brought up is that the funding for that monitoring has been inequitable. So I mentioned this before, but just to recap, the reason that it is inequitable is that DEED has not received a funding source for that part of its job, and so it contacted some of these organizations, and a small number of them agreed to take a piece of their appropriation, give it back to DEED for monitoring purposes. But for the most part, and it's understandable, the organizations that were contacted did not agree. So we recommend that DEED be more consistent in its monitoring of the organizations, the recipients of the legislative appropriations, and we think that DEED should develop a proposal that more equitably funds its monitoring of these organizations. I'm going to, at this point...
Before you go forward, I think Representative Winkler had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is an issue of grants management that is not just specific to DEED. It is an issue that is across all state agencies. And I know that your office has done excellent work in this area and have looked at this issue more broadly. And in the State Government Finance Committee, generally, and there is... been a discussion about this, and the fact is that we do have a state office of grants management, and it consists, I believe, of one person who is responsible for overseeing all state agency grants, and it was not created until 2008. So in general, it's not just DEED, but in general, we are doing a poor job of providing oversight through the administration of grants that are administered in lots of departments. I don't know if you agree with that, but that's my observation. And I wonder if the recommendation to have DEED develop this shouldn't be more broadly applied to a wider enterprise effort to provide grant oversight. And the funding mechanism could be that everybody just has to pay a small percentage of their grant towards this kind of administrative oversight, which is typical in the nonprofit world.
Do I sense a bill coming forward? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, there have been bills. What there hasn't been is a lot of energy, among others, to support them.
Yeah, we should meet later. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Howard, on the question of monitoring, what does that consist currently, and what should it consist of?
Mr. Chair and Representative, DEED has policies in place that govern what the monitoring should consist of, and they have a set of policies that govern fiscal monitoring and then a separate set of policies governing the programmatic monitoring. Their policy, I believe, calls for annual on-site monitoring regarding the fiscal piece of that, but less frequent, I think, every other year, if I remember correctly, for the programmatic piece of that. And the actual components of the monitoring is also laid out in their policies in terms of what they're looking for. They have, in fact, it's maybe a 6 or 7 page, maybe longer, guide sheet that the monitors take with them, and they will ask us a prescribed set of questions. They as a part of that, they will be looking at a sample of case files when they're on site to review to make sure that all obligations were met. So the monitoring is in depth. It's not just a cursory look at what, you know, how much money came in and how much money left.
Thank you. Representative Pepin, did you have a question? And then we're going to let you finish your conclusions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, mine is a very broad question for Mr. Nobles, and it's not specifically, it's just a broad question.
Why don't we wait till the conclusions,
okay,
and then
that's fine.
I'll put you first on the list for the questions after that.
Perfect. All right. Well, I'm at the point where I want to just sum up what it is we found, at least the major findings. I do want to mention that the report contains some other findings, but we tried to focus on what we thought were the major ones today. So, in sum, the first one that I spoke about was that the federal measures now in place are inadequate to measure in a comprehensive way the success or the good performance or poor performance of a program. We also found that the accountability for the workforce programs is diffuse. That's due to the fragmented authority that is a part of the workforce investment system, and also due in part to the funding that is segregated in those funding stream silos to individual programs. Federal law, though, and federal regulation does limit what the state can do to change that. Another conclusion is that the workforce center programs are only partially integrated with related programs, such as unemployment insurance that we talked about at more length today. And those gaps in service are things that concern us. The legislative appropriations to independent providers and the Job Skills Partnership Board's allocations for the small layoff events bypass a competitive selection process that we think is important. And finally, DEED's monitoring of the providers that receive those direct legislative appropriations has been inconsistent and funded unfairly. So just a summary of the recommendations we make is that first, DEED should have and use a more comprehensive set of performance measures, not performance measures per se, but standard approaches that can be used in addition to the performance measures to understand more fully whether the programs are successful. We recommend that the Governor's Workforce Development Council lead a process that would, along with the workforce councils and along with DEED, help identify local gaps in service and talk about ways to address those gaps. We recommend that DEED's Unemployment Insurance Division develop a way or multiple ways to refer to its customer service staff those Workforce Center clients who come in and have difficulty navigating those automated systems. We recommend that the legislature allow recipients of the workforce grants to be selected through a competitive process. And finally, we recommend that DEED more consistently monitor the recipients of the legislative appropriations and find a more equitable way of funding its monitoring. So with that, Mr. Chair, I conclude my formal remarks. I would be remiss if I failed to point out the help that we received on the evaluation. Although, as Jim Nobles mentioned, I led the managed the program evaluation. I worked with two excellent staff members who are here in the audience. David Kirchner and Julie Chupke-Bastidas, who are sitting behind me, were instrumental to making sure we finished the report that we've got in front of us today. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I could answer any other questions you might have.
Well, I'd like to compliment the staff also. Anyone that manages knows that the staff does a lion's share of the work and the other person gets the credit. So thank you so very, very much. We appreciate that. I'm going to make just a quick comment, and then I'm going to get to Representative Pepin's. The only disappointment in this report is that it wasn't 4 years ago prior to our recession, so that we could have gotten the most bang for that $230 million that we're spending on a year, because the economy's changing, and this was a perfect opportunity to put a lot of people into training facilities and training programs that would have grown the economy over the next 20 and 30 and 50 years. So with that, Representative Pepin, your broad question, and be careful here, because I know you can sometimes open up a whole new can of worms.
Mr. Chair.
I know.
thank you. Mr. Nobles, as you know, I'm on state government finance, and so we've kind of talked about some of these issues before, but I guess my question is overall on the Office of the Legislative Auditor and on specifically the Program Evaluation Division. I believe you have something like 60 employees or something, and do you have something like 60 employees?
In our program evaluation,
and then like 14
Chairman,
for the
in our program evaluation division, we currently have 12.
Okay. And I was looking at your mission, and it says is to determine, the mission is to determine the degree to which state agencies and programs are accomplishing their goals and objectives and utilizing resources efficiently. And I think that's a great goal. And I think that I've read many of these recommendations, and you always have a lot of really good recommendations, but my concern has always been the lack of action on your recommendations. So I'm just kind of wondering, have you ever done any sort of analysis as to how many of the recommendations that you've provided to the legislature or to agencies have actually been addressed by those agencies or the legislature? Because my concern is that the power to actually make the changes hasn't been exercised within the OLA, and I'd just like you to comment on that.
Mr. Chairman and members, it's an excellent question. It's something we obviously deal with a lot, and we are in the process of following up on a number of our evaluations. We do that every year and try to determine, without completely redoing the evaluation, what has happened, both in the agency and at the legislature. And frankly, it's a mixed picture. I mean, we have some reports that we've issued where there's been very significant action by the legislature or the agency. And sometimes it's a combination of the two. I think of, for example, our report on Job Z, which there were some recommendations to the legislature that were not enacted, but the commissioner, who is here, I think took that report very seriously and made a lot of reforms and changes. But I could point to other reports, for example, where we made recommendations to the legislature. Integration revenue would be a good example, a report we issued several years ago and had a wide range of recommendations for the legislature, and you have yet to enact those. But we did get a lot of attention and consideration of our recommendations, and we understand that sometimes we make recommendations that are difficult for you to implement, particularly in the area of our program evaluations. With our financial audits, it's more a matter of agencies doing the implementation, and we do, again, follow-up work, and I'd say almost all, with rare exception, of our recommendations on financial audits are implemented. But by the very nature of the mission, the purpose of evaluations that you read, we get into some pretty complex issues of policy and programs. And we understand that it's one thing for us to go off and do an evaluation and look at the data. It's another for you to confront, frankly, the politics of that. And there are many different kinds of politics that come into play. It's not just a matter of partisan politics. It's regional politics. It's interest group politics. It's all kind. And you're the people that are elected to make those decisions. And we, I think you give us a very good consideration. We're here today. We have these opportunities often to come to committees and make our presentation. We talk to you individually. And we think that's a very fortunate thing for an organization like ours to get that amount of attention. But I think you would expect us to be respectful of your role as elected officials in ultimately deciding whether or not to go forward with recommendations such as on Green Acres, on one that was fairly controversial, or frankly on the recommendations that we've brought to you today. I mean, we are very boldly saying to you that we don't think you ought to earmark appropriations for nonprofits. That's going to be a difficult recommendation for you to fully implement, I'm sure, because there are interest groups out there that you as members have connections with, that you have loyalty to, that you believe in, and they will come here and lobby you. And you will, I would predict, continue to make some appropriations to those. But I'm also sure you're going to give due consideration to our concerns about the lack of accountability and monitoring. So it's a very mixed picture.
Pardon?
Just follow up.
Quickly, because we've got three. I do want people to understand that we have the Commissioner of Deed, we have the Chair of the Workforce Council, and we have Minsky here to kind of give their view on this. So I have, I'll give you a quick. Okay, Representative Reinhart and then Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we probably will have a further discussion about this, but the competitive selection process, I would be really interested in specific elements of your advice in terms of our targeted audience for the various grants, because I think we would have a number of RFPs, if you will, and because if you look at the audiences that some of our grants are targeted to, clearly they're specific, disabled, blind, certain populations by gender or socioeconomic, or, you know, so those different populations don't match up to in terms of a common competitive process. So I'd be interested in some advice to us on how to proceed in developing that process effectively.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, DEED has a process in place already and actually uses it. It's a competitive process that is used for awarding grants to many of the vocational rehabilitation service community providers. And vocational rehabilitation services are targeted at people with disabilities to help them either find jobs or retain employment. So, I mean, there is a process already out there. And beyond that, for the large layoffs, so those events that have 50 or more people laid off in a single event, right now that's done in a competitive way. The providers out there, who they have to meet certain qualification requirements, of course, but those who are qualified will submit a bid whenever a large layoff event occurs. And the people involved in that layoff get to choose which provider who submitted a bid is the one they think would best provide meet their needs. So there's some experience already within DEED of a competitive process for selecting the vendors.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could just add, we asked DEED as we met with them to review our draft report whether or not in fact there would be competition on some of the grants that the legislature has awarded directly, and they said yes, that even when you get down to trying to target money towards very specific populations, that there is more than one provider that could potentially put in a bid or make a proposal to an RFP. So again, I just echo what Ms. Howard said. That process is already out there, and so that would be our recommendation that it be followed.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. Did you have a point to this?
And I think this would be worth two hearings. There's a lot to digest. There's a lot to go over. So if we need to, as a member of the committee, I certainly would favor inviting Minsky and Deed and other people back to go through this in greater detail. I think that'd be well worth our committee time. But I think it bears noting that the total amount of grants that the state of Minnesota provides in aggregate equals the amount that we purchase through procurement. And we have, you know, people can go to jail for violating procurement laws. And we really have nothing that is systemic and statutory based for grant applications. And so I think this is just one part, and I'm going to reiterate this, of a much larger issue that we at the legislature need to consider, and also the administration, because I know that these nonprofits are also included in the governor's budget recommendations, and some of them were cut back, some were eliminated, some were in there, and this is something that is a problem in the culture in the legislature and the administration about just kind of going along with what we've done in the past instead of carefully reconsidering it every once in a while. So that's why this is valuable. I do hope we spend more time on it.
Ms. Haas, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. Just a short comment. As you open up the field for a more competitive nature within your grants to nonprofits, as Representative Winker was saying, that you know, you have to audit, but that's auditing after the fact, and I think that's good. But if you start opening it up, you better audit before the fact as well. These people coming in better have a good basis, a good sound basis, and have an auditable background before you give them money. Because after you give them money, they're gone, they disintegrate, and then you know that they've done you. Right? So there is a difference there. One of the reasons that many of the organizations that are getting money
are receiving money is because they have a history of honesty and a history of good records, and you have trust in them. The second on the correspondence to when you audit and we write policy in accordance to that, we think that would be just the most wonderful policy to follow that. As you point out, you have policy and you have politics, and then you have reality and reality. I mean, if you go back with Green Acres and you read the reason that Green Acres was put into law because of the state audit, it makes a hell of a lot of sense. If you stand in front of the group at Truth and Taxation time and they yell, give us Barabbas, it does not make that much sense. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, that's why I would just echo again why I respect you as the elected, because you have to go to those town meetings and be accountable. And sometimes you invite us to come with you.
Just so you know, no one brought up Green Acres at any town hall meeting that I went to. So.
Too bad.
Exactly.
I'm going to ask, thank you. Thank you so very much. I'm sure you're going to be around, and I highly recommend that the committee members, and I will look at it at another hearing on this if we can, but I would hope that members would call the auditor's office and get a few more details, because there are really good recommendations, some of them easier than others, some of them, I guess they'd call them, what is it, IEDs. With that, I'm going to actually call down two people, because we've got a short amount of time and a lot of people. So the Commissioner of Deed and McElroy and Linda Blair from Bear from Minsky, if you could both come to the table and give your responses. Oh, okay. The person? Oh, all right. And Mr. McElroy, if you could, because we've got about 20 minutes left, so if you could do your five-minute elevator speech.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And we did prepare a document, and I'll go through it very briefly. In the audience are a number of people prepared to give me technical support if we get into some details. But first of all, let me thank Ms. Hauer, her staff, Auditor Nobles for their work. Thank the legislature for requesting this study. We're not aware that anything quite like this had been done before. We found it very helpful. We have underway already measures to take advantage of some of these recommendations and suggestions. There's one in here that I want to talk about that we don't 100% agree with. I think I understand it a little better now that I heard Jody talk about it, and we agree in part. Let me briefly go through this document, and it Please. Goes through major conclusions, and then we'll take your questions. Major finding number one is that accountability for workforce programs is diffuse, and it's a function of federal law. We are working with the National Association of State Workforce Agencies, and the Minnesota Workforce Council Association is working with their national group to try and make some improvements in that. There are also things that we can continue to work on together. If we can't fix the law, we can increase our collaboration. But the federal law is very siloed, and there are rules that certain, like vocational rehabilitation people, can only report to people in a direct line to the director of rehabilitation services. And not quite that strict with vets or state services for the blind. When I was in your position, Mr. Chair, I said that one of the challenges of these programs is they deal with federal rule books that come on wheels. Now they come on CDs. And there are, in some cases, several of them. And we do our best to deal with them. It would be better. And we're working. We want to thank Senator Franken, who's on the appropriate committee on help. And if WEA gets authorized either this year or next year, we hope some of that will be simpler. Major finding number two is that we are only partially integrated with unemployment insurance, adult basic education, and some training programs, leaving what the auditor used the term gaps, and that's appropriate. We're committed to find ways to make unemployment insurance work better with the Workforce Center programs. I appreciate the reference in the audit report that it's not realistic to decentralize customer service. We couldn't do it efficiently enough to take the amount of money that we're provided and the number of people who need benefits and provide service if we spread people across 49 Workforce Centers. But we have scheduled in early March what's called in lean process improvement system, a Kaizen event, to bring together the right people to develop business processes. And I'm a little concerned about creating direct lines to customer service people that bypass information gathering or kind of the system, but maybe that's the right approach. And I appreciate Ms. Hauer's connection that people to machine isn't always very satisfying. The people to people, even today, probably audio, in the future, perhaps a video via the web, we can do better. The connections to adult basic education and MNSCU are also things that we work on. ABE has 53 consortiums across the state. I think about half of them have a presence in workforce centers, some of them less so. The governance of ABE is through the Minnesota Department of Education, but through a project called Fast Track. We've been working closely with ABE. We have an ABE employee that now offices at DEED, and we're making some progress on this, but it is fairly siloed systematically. We also work very closely with the MNSCU system and, again, have some employees that are cross-located. I'm a trustee of the MNSCU system, and that's been helpful for us to know what each other are doing. But the campuses are governed and funded separately. They have accreditation issues as to when they can start programs and what accredited programs look like. Dr. Baer can comment on that. We think we're making progress, but we don't disagree at all that there are separations of the services. If we ran the community college program, you could start training classes at least monthly. That isn't always practical from the college's point of view. And so it's we agree with the concern. We're working already to make some progress on it. The third finding, I think, has been discussed sufficiently. Legislative appropriations to independent workforce providers bypass the selection process. We work with them when you make that. We're going to find ways to monitor them more equitably. I appreciate Representative Winkler's suggestion that we need some authority there. We only asked the providers with larger appropriations, and some were willing to fund monitoring and some were not. There is a federal law prohibiting us from using any federal funds or people funded through federal programs to monitor state grants. We simply can't do that. And we don't get a general fund appropriation that provides monitoring staff. So we end up using, and we do our best to get it done. But we, and based on this audit, we're going to find more ways to get done. Whether I have to learn to do monitoring visits myself, we will get monitored.
Commissioner Macro, I think this committee has gotten a message from the audit, and we will find a way to recommend to the Finance Committee what they do. We will find that. Give you that as my assurance, is that we are going to get some accountability in the whole system and pay for it.
And I was pleased to hear Ms. Hauer say that she thinks the monitoring process that we use, and it's quite complete, we simply haven't had the resources to do enough of it, and we will do more. Major finding number three is the one issue where we have some disagreement, but as I listened to Ms. Hauer, I may understand it better. Most of the resources for serving people in small layoffs go by formula to the workforce service agencies based on the number of unemployed people that they have and some population factors, so that they have resources for kind of their base services to dislocated workers as well as for training, and so they can be responsive when small layoffs occur. I originally thought what the auditor was recommending is that we change that allocation to a competitive process through the Job Skills Partnership Board, and I don't know how we would be responsive enough to needs across the state. If the recommendation is only for those independent service providers, that they have to compete on a more regular basis, I want to work on that, have that discussion with the Workforce Center Association, with the providers from the Job Skills Partnership Board. That may be workable. But to take all the state dislocated worker money and have it not have a formula allocation for a base the workforce service areas can depend on, we think that's problematic.
Mr. Andre, could you jump to six? Because I really am going to be tied in for time here if I don't.
Got it. When we looked at this recommendation, we took into consideration that the clients served were served from July of 2007 through the end of 2009, when getting a job has been increasingly difficult. But with that said, we have we will roll out the first week in March a tighter connection, an automatic connection, that when someone signs up in the Workforce Center for Services, they can choose to automatically be enrolled in the same process at MinnesotaWorks.net, which is our online job bank. We will add questions to our satisfaction survey, asking people about the connection between the services we provide and employers. We understand this. The survey was done during a time that there weren't enough employers hiring and that there was difficult to get jobs. But the purpose of the program is not to train people for training's sake, but to train people to get better, good-paying jobs, and we understand that.
I'm gonna stop you right there. I think we probably are going to have people coming back to discuss this a couple more times, but I know Representative Rukavina is going to have this report in his committee. So with that, I'm sure you're going to get another chance, and all the support staff that you brought, that's we'll have another hearing, a couple more hearings, so hopefully we'll get more time.
And all right.
Sorry. Minskew.
Thank you. I'm Linda Baer, the Senior Vice Chancellor for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I'm pleased to be here. Basically, the report had two main topics that were of concern, particularly to the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. On the first point about the way we do offer courses, we're firmly committed to offering courses. That's our business. The courses are in non-credit and in credit. There is also a bias toward making sure training is happening in short-term basis to make sure people are trained, but in credit courses, and then out back to the workforce as the workforce can accept them. We have been serving dislocated and unemployed workers for some time. We appreciate the opportunity where we have co-located workforce centers on our campuses, and by the way, there are about seven of those at this time. They have been determined with extensive consultation with communities about whether that fits the need of the community best, and we know where they are there, they work well. We are very accountable. We are certified. We work very closely with DEED in relation to that, so our programs do have to meet the WEA certification standards. We look at our outcomes, and in fact, our dashboard for our Board of Trustees does include placement, licensure pass rates, and other accountability indicators. We have talked this year in it adding and have added services to dislocated workers. I believe that your questions from the audit report had to do with why weren't we serving in more flexible and adaptable ways. Many of our campuses are. As workers have come through the doors, whenever they come through the doors, many of our campuses have responded. They've been able to put short-term courses together. They've been able to have people enter at the time when they needed to enter. I have also been very heartened to see the student reaction, many of them non-traditional students that have come forward to help and walk people through those doors, because there's nothing more intimidating than to be maybe 50, 55 years old and told go to a computer lab and start working on an application. And so our students have joined hands with those dislocated people. People have been there before and said, we're going to help you out. We're going to open up these computer labs, and our campuses did do that. And they've put people there to assist people, to walk them through what can be some of them there to assist people, to walk them through what can be some of the most significant transition they're making in their lives today. I have more examples of that. I would say that our enrollments have increased phenomenally, probably upwards of 17% this year alone. Our retention of underrepresented students, a high priority for our board and for our chancellor and our campuses, up 22% fall to fall. We're doing some good things to help our students stay successful in our campuses.
Ms. Baer, I'm going to stop you there and ask for the Workforce Council Association to come down. But I will just relay that what I am hearing is that the Minskew system has not responded with short-term certification programs to the level that is needed. So hopefully we can work with that. Thank you.
It is in some areas.
Thank you for joining us today. Please identify yourself for the record and give us your 5 minutes, please.
Well, good morning, Chairman, representatives. I'm Kathy Weick, and I am the chair of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association, and I chair the Dakota Scott Workforce Investment Board. As a member of the board, I'm a private industry member, so I find great interest in these results. I really will only take a second, and I want to compliment you, and I want to compliment the auditor's office. It is an important role we play, but it is only a piece of the puzzle, and this report really does an excellent job of describing how all those pieces come together. I, in fact, will make Chapter 1, which is the background information required reading for our members. I would refer you to the report, which includes our formal comment letter. Many of the recommendations we do agree with. One of the things, especially since there's been so much discussion around evaluation and doing a better job, as we are made up of private industry individuals, many who have had a good opportunity and do a lot of evaluative work, we really would like an opportunity, we the Workforce Council Association and the individual WIBs, to help in and work with whatever new measures are established. And we'd ask that they not be redundant so that we don't spend our time doing analysis and evaluation and not being able to serve. So again, thank you. And I'll let Jerry say his words.
I'm Jerry Vitzthum, director of the Anoka County Workforce Area, the staff to the centers. And I really don't have anything to say other than I agree with the observations. We think it's a great piece of reading and worth doing. A lot of good observations, a lot of good things to look at. And I'm just here if there's any questions, we could answer those.
There is no one on the question list. But I suspect if members take a few minutes to read this report, I was just informed by staff that it's certainly easy for us to bring this back on Tuesday. And if there's a desire to do that, I will. And give me a show of hands. How many of the members would like to see this again on Tuesday? That's a majority. So hopefully the auditor can make someone available. Deed can make someone available, Minsky, and you folks can make yourselves available. I did not get a chance to read it too long, but in the 45 minutes I did get a chance to read it, I tabbed it at about 8 or 9 different areas. So I think there's a lot to be learned here, and I hope if we can get a few moments at the end of Tuesday to talk about some ideas from this report that we can turn into a bill and move forward. There's a whole slew of things in here. So thank you so very, very much. And before I end 5 minutes early, I'm going to say that there is a DFL meeting at noon in 400 South. Talk a little bit. So with that, members, thank you for your attention, and I hope you get this read over the weekend. Adjourned.